Hello and welcome to this ninth episode of Checking the Gate, a Film and Religion podcast. I am the co-host Robert Wright Stasko, and my other co-host is
Michael M. Patty.
And we're here today, we're going to talk about a couple things. We're going to tackle the Indiana Jones trilogy.
Not quartet trilogy.
I might force you to talk about the Crystal Skulls. We'll see. But in our TV corner, we're going to be talking about a Charlie Brown Christmas.
Which is so timely for the beginning of January.
Yes. Well, we just finished unwrapping presents for each other, so Mike got me something really cool. He got me the Lord of the Rings Pez set.
And Robert got me a series of Evolution of the Cylon mini statuettes, which has six little display figures that you line up, and they look like the traditional walking man, only it goes from a toaster up to number six.
It is fantastic.
It sure is.
I saw that, and I said, I have to get that from Mike. It's the best.
And I thought the same thing about the Pez dispensers.
So thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you. You are very welcome.
Merry Christmas to you.
Yes, and Merry Christmas to you.
I think we're going to get started. Well, this month has been a big month for movies. We've had trailers for The Dark Knight, for The Hobbit, which is not necessarily a film and religion thing, but Tolkien was a Catholic, and a lot of people try and put religious connotations to his writings, even though he said, I can't stand allegory if I even smell it.
Yeah, don't tell C.S. Lewis that.
Yeah, well, C.S. Lewis, his stuff dripped with allegory. I mean, it was puddled on the floor. So, but
I think I got some on me.
Let me wipe that allegory off of you. The most intriguing trailer we've seen is for the new Ridley Scott movie Prometheus.
That's just fantastic from start to finish. It doesn't tell you anything about the plot, but it's clear from the get-go. It's tied into the Alien franchise, once again directed by Ridley Scott, who I think is one of the better directors still working. I know a lot of people didn't like it. I liked Robin Hood. I liked American Gangster. I thought that was okay. Kingdom of Heaven was all right. So hopefully his return to sci-fi will be that much better.
What's great about the Kingdom of Heaven DVD, it has a text commentary where it tells you the actual facts and dates and names of the people, places, and battles of the Crusades. So that it's very educational that way. But Prometheus, I think we'll be covering when it comes out this summer because it deals with our origins as a species. If you look at religions across the board, that's one of the questions that religion seeks to answer is where did we come from? And I'm interested to see what Ridley Scott's take is on that.
I'm interested to see if there are chest bursters.
That would be cool. I think a lot of people are anticipating that. But I've heard conflicting things from the director and the stars and whether or not there's going to be real aliens in here. So we'll see. I know the space jockey is supposed to make an appearance.
Which is why I'm thinking, how can there not be real aliens?
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. As long as they're not multidimensional aliens, right?
Right.
Which brings us back to our movie that we're talking about. So let's start talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark. I don't think we need to do any plot recaps for these, because if you haven't seen it, where have you been?
Yeah. It's like we say every episode, if you haven't seen the movie, why are you listening to the show? You'll be completely lost, and chances are you'll be missing out on a fine film. So we haven't done a stinker on this show in a while.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that when we talk about Crystal Skull. I'm going to make you
what,
talk
what,
about
what is that? You keep mentioning that, and I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, for now, we'll start with the Raiders. Hey, I kept trying to find this quote from George Lucas, where he says something like, you know, Indy starts out as a skeptic, and he ends up as an agnostic. I know I saw it somewhere in a documentary or one of the making of videos. I could not find it, but I know that's kind of the character arc that he wanted Indy to take. And that's pretty much what happens in all of these movies, but to varying degrees.
I don't know that I'd agree that he's a skeptic, because he never seems to be surprised by what he finds. You know what I mean? It's always like another day at the office for Indiana Jones. Oh, look, there's the Ark of the... And he just happens to know not to look at the spirits. I think they mention it in passing, what the Ark of the Covenant does. And he just happens to know that you're not supposed to look at it. There's no indication that he is familiar with the Bible verses that I think you have. I assume you'll put those in the show notes. The Bible verses that are mentioned that they took the inspiration for the story from. Those aren't mentioned anywhere in the movie, but he's familiar with the Ark of the Covenant. They do say that it contains the remnants of the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, that scene where Belloc is like, it's a radio to God. It kind of mirrors what actually happens in the Bible when the Israelites get a little full of themselves and like, oh, we'll go fight the Philistines. We'll just trot out the Ark. Every time we do that, we win, but they're putting their faith more in the Ark than they were in God. And they lose the battle. They lose the fight. The Philistines take the Ark away from him. And that's sort of the beginning of the backstory here where the Ark is lost and...
Not found until 1938?
Yes, 38. In the Well of Souls. Yeah. So... But in real life, people are still searching for the Ark. There's a story where someone thought they found it in Ethiopia, and they realized, oh, this is the exact spot where the Ark is buried. It must be directly underneath my feet. And he fell down and died because he was standing in the Holy of Holies, you know? There's always that sort of kernel of truth which these movies are based on. On IMDb, there's a quote there where they followed the instructions for constructing the Ark in the movie. That's found in Exodus 25:10. And Belloc's clothing is found in Exodus chapter 28. But in the end, do you think that Indiana Jones becomes a true believer?
No.
No, I don't think so either.
It goes back to my point a minute ago. It's all in a day's work for him. He is neither moved nor convinced. He doesn't have a crisis of faith. It doesn't faze him. He's unflappable in the face of these big, magical, mysterious things going on around him. He's more concerned about protecting the artifacts and the history than trying to prove anything.
Yeah, it's like his mantra is, this belongs in a museum. That's his religious conviction. You know?
Is that one in Raiders? I know it's in Last Crusade.
That's in Last Crusade, but... Well, if we move on to Temple of Doom, the second movie... It actually takes place a year before Raiders of the Lost Ark. We don't see that kind of...
No, it's... Except for the date at the beginning, there's no indication that it takes place before or after. There's no character development.
I think there is, because he's not so much an academic as he is trying to seek fame and fortune and glory. He's going to find it in the Sankara Stones. I know this one is not a lot of people's favorites. It's actually...
I don't like it.
You don't like it?
Not really.
Tell us why.
Short Round is annoying. Kate Capshaw is annoying. The terrible looking by today's standards, Mind Chase. My parents took me to see Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom in 1983 when I was 6 or 7 years old, which features monkey brains and a heart being ripped out of a still living person. That may have something to do with it. It's just... not as good. It has nothing to do with the fact that it's an Indian myth that he's chasing down. It's just not a very good story. It's not as good as Raiders or Last Crusade.
Yeah. I like Short Round. I think he's funny. He's hilarious. Hang on, wait, are we going far wide? I love that. I love that.
Oh,
no
look.
Time for love, Dr. Jones.
Yeah. Oh, look, the Asian kid speaks broken English. That's hilarious.
Well, I like that he's kind of grown up and streetwise, and, you know, he's gambling with Indy. And
that's every movie sidekick kid.
Oh, but he's great. He's got all the Jackie Chan moves. I'm not going to win this argument, am I?
We're going to have to agree to disagree on Short Round.
Well, I did some research. I wasn't sure that the Sankara Stones were actual things, like the Grail or the Ark.
I thought I had read that was... a thing, much like the Grail and the Ark were.
Yeah.
It just wasn't as widely known.
I did some research. I pulled out one of my old textbooks from school, from my world religions course, the book called Living Religions by Mary Pat Fisher. And there are stones called lingam, which are supposed to be the formless representations of Siva, when Indiana Jones first sort of descends from the sky down the river into the Indian village. The head of the village says, "Siva sent you to recover our stones." And Indy's like, "No, no, no, not really." But these Siva Linga or Lingam, you'll find them in different villages, and they take different shapes. There's one Lingam that's in a cave. It's made out of ice. It's huge. But they all have the same sort of shape that we see in the movie. So I thought that was interesting. The thing I didn't think was part of anything Indian was the voodoo doll thing that they did. Or the Maharaja was stabbing Indy.
That's a completely different regional tradition, isn't it?
Yeah, that's like Jamaican voodoo, you know?
But it looks good on film.
Yeah, but the ending, I think, is the most interesting because Indiana Jones shows, I think, that probably the greatest show of, in Christianity, we call it the Burning with the Spirit, when he and Molaram are hanging off the bridge. And they're fighting over the stones. And he's like, "You betrayed Siva." And he starts speaking Sanskrit. And the stones start flaming. And I think that's the most religious fervor I think we ever see out of Indy.
All I have to say about that is the ending is the best part. That bridge scene is kind of cool.
Yeah. I love that. And Harrison Ford has never looked better. I mean, he's like all stringy and wiry.
And the look of Mola Ram was neat. I thought they did a good job making him look like a good movie villain.
In the making of DVD, the other Indian actor in there was saying that he always had like a full head of hair, the actor who played Mola Ram, and he shaved it for that role and just kept shaving it and played a bunch of bad guys. He went on to have a great career playing bad guys in Indian
good
and
for
Bollywood.
Him.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah. So, well, let's move on to The Last Crusade.
Yes, the final Indiana Jones film.
Yeah.
This one, I think, is my favorite. I like Last Crusade more than Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's more fun. Sean Connery is great. Harrison Ford is great.
There's a ton more comedy in this one than the first two combined.
It's not even about the comedy. The hunting for the Grail is... It's a more easily accessible quest to go on, I think.
The thing with the Grail, though, is there's no basis for this relic in biblical fact. I mean, the Bible doesn't make a big deal about the Holy Grail and
who
this is really more medieval myth and legend that we're hunting after. But you know, my problem is, why would you have this Grail which could give you eternal life? Why would God go through all the trouble of dying and then raising from the grave? If just this cup would solve all our problems and, you know, make us live forever.
I actually didn't know that it wasn't in the Bible as much as the Ark of the Covenant. Robert went to religion school, and I did not. So that's interesting. I know about it from Arthurian legend and, of course, from Monty Python. So that's where my Grail knowledge comes from. Do you have any other interesting real-life facts about it? Do you know how that started then?
I don't know. I think it was, you know...
Somebody in medieval times decided, hey, you know what? Jesus must have been drinking something the night he died. I bet I could live forever like him.
Yeah.
And then it just got carried away.
Yeah, the legend is that the cup that Jesus used to take the first communion, Mary used that cup to collect some of the blood that... came from his wounds off when he was hanging on the cross.
That's right. I've heard that before.
Yeah. So, yeah, Grail lore, it's fascinating and has kept people occupied and obsessed like Indy's father. But I think what makes this movie better than the other one is the heart of the story is Indy's search for his father. You know, and Spielberg said, you know, the search for the Grail is the search for the father. And that's what gives this movie heart and soul, and really puts a nice end to the trilogy.
Yes, he's not just looking for something to put in the museum. He's, you know, looking for something he lost personally. On a related note, if I can, you know, touch on the film aspect, they cast Sean Connery as his dad without any indication that Indiana Jones has any Scottish heritage in his background, not counting the awful accent he does in Last Crusade.
That's funny.
You're
a Scottish, then I am Mickey Mouse.
It's completely plausible, having seen Sean Connery as James Bond, and then as the more bookish Henry Jones, it's completely plausible that he is Indiana Jones's father in that movie.
Yeah, they thought it was going to be a problem since they're actually only 7 years apart.
Really?
Yeah.
Seven?
Yeah.
That's it?
That's it. Sean Connery's actually 7 years older than Harrison Ford, but that's movie magic
but
for they're, you.
Yeah, it's acting.
Yeah, and they had such good chemistry together.
Yeah.
And the other problem I kind of had was on the last test when he has to take a leap of faith from the lion's head. He kind of puts his hand on his chest and kind of musters up faith. After the show of faith he had with the Sivalinga, it didn't really do it for me. It's like, can you all of a sudden muster up faith in God? I don't know.
It makes a good end to the movie.
Yeah. But, and that, I remember first seeing that in the theater, that effect kind of blew me away, where he like hit the step and then they did the camera pull away and you see the bridge and it's,
that I was like cool. That.
So, excellent filmmaking and special effects.
I like to share a personal memory. I saw that in the theater, and I had to cover my eyes when, again, I was 12, I think. What year did it come out? 89?
89, yeah.
I was not yet 12. When Donovan gets old and melts, I still had to cover my eyes at age 11. My parents, they didn't have the internet, so they couldn't check what was family-friendly in these things, so...
I'm going to make you talk about the next movie.
All right, I'm going to drop the pretense.
Which is not so excellent, or...
It's awful. I've seen it twice.
I watched it recently with the riff tracks.
Did you watch it on USA when they ran it commercial-free?
Oh, no.
Yeah, they had it on USA HD, commercial-free, original aspect ratio. They bleeped out a swear word. That was it. That was the only cut they made.
Yeah.
And so I watched it again, and it was not any better.
I mean,
was still redonkulous.
Yeah. Overall, I don't think it was bad, because I saw the interviews and read the Vanity Fair article with George Lucas and everywhere. They're explaining, okay, this takes place in the 50s. The original trilogy took place in the 30s, and we're copying the feel of the Republic serials. Here we're going to copy the feel of the 50s B-movie.
Yeah, that's all well and good. But then they went and had him hide in a refrigerator from a nuclear explosion. And... had Shia LaBeouf swinging from CGI vines from man-eating gophers, or
I'll give you that. That was awful. And
let's not forget not forget the man-eating ants.
The ants is cool because that was like
not cool.
That was like the bugs and the rats and the snakes. They had
and it's
that.
Bugs. It's bugs again.
What other things are there? You only have three things. You have to start. They're gonna have to do snakes.
Dogs,
again.
Dogs, pack of wild dogs.
Dogs are cuddly, you know. Ants are not cuddly. Rats are not cuddly. Actually,
that's exactly why they catch you unawares. You know why? Why did the MacGuffin have to be? I don't know. Maybe I missed something. I had never heard of the whole crystal skull thing from the 50s, that they might be aliens. And then the way it ended, where they're not really aliens. They're from another dimension, traveling through time. Or
They're multidimensional archaeologists.
Thank you.
Yeah, that
again,
was kind of hokey.
It could have been, if they had hired, I think they did hire a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And if they had hired somebody else and spent another half hour coming up with a different... story, you know, it's
but
just the overall story I didn't like, and the details I didn't like. A lot of times, if one's off, the other will make up for it, I found in a lot of movies. For instance, Ghostbusters. They don't have a cohesive villain throughout the piece. Gozer and the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man just show up at the end, and yeah, they talk about them.
Yeah.
But they don't have screen. They're not characters in it. They just show up at the end. But it's made up of moments.
Yeah,
it's a lot of solid moments that combine together and make a classic film.
Right, there's a lot of build-up to that.
At the same time, there are movies that are good ideas that are just, they're focused and they have one good idea and it's a good, solid story. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull has none of those things. There is nothing working for it. First of all, it's a completely unnecessary sequel. I liked that they got Karen Allen back as Marion. It was good to see her and Harrison Ford again. They had good chemistry. I'll even go so far as to say, if they had to cast someone to play Indy's son, Shia LaBeouf is fine. He looks like he could be the child of Harrison Ford and Karen Allen. All right,
yeah.
I will buy that. My big problem is completely with the writing. And the special effects aren't great either. But that's neither here nor there. That doesn't make or break a movie. The writing is just atrocious. The plot is terrible, and it didn't need to be made. If it was going to be made, they should have done a little more quality control and made it better.
Yeah.
And now they're talking about making a fifth one, which is even less mandatory.
Yeah. And
what are they going to search for now?
The rumor is it's going to be more about Shia LaBeouf, and he's going to pick up the mantle of the Indy franchise. That's the rumor. I hope it's not true. But talk about the story. This one was definitely Lucas.
Yeah.
This is one like Temple of Doom. When that movie was being made, Lucas was going through a divorce, and he was getting his heart ripped out. So he put that on screen.
You can totally tell. A lot of people don't like Return of the Jedi because they don't like the Ewoks. They think they're too soft and cuddly. I don't have that problem. However, you can see a marked difference in the quality in the way Return of the Jedi is so long. His wife was his editor.
Yeah.
You can really tell between the way Star Wars feels, the way Empire feels, even though it's got a different tone, they're still kind of cohesive. And then Return of the Jedi, which is a good 10 or 15 minutes longer than Empire Strikes Back. And it doesn't need to be. That's when his wife left him, and I think you can see it.
Yeah. I didn't think about that, but you're absolutely right on that.
Yeah. And everything that he has worked on since. All right, I'll give Last Crusade an exception.
Yeah.
But the three Star Wars prequels, none of those hold a candle to Star Wars and Empire or even Return of the Jedi. Just focus-wise, writing-wise.
Like, some of the best scenes in Star Wars, he didn't even write. Like, the scene where Luke's trying to convince Han to go rescue Princess Leia.
They're gonna execute her! Better her than me!
Yeah, that isn't Lucas at all. That someone else came in and wrote that stuff. And here in Crystal Skull, that was his MacGuffin the whole time, because apparently he became obsessed with these things.
I don't even mind it being about aliens. When it was first announced, there was a rumor that it would be about Area 51, a number of years after the Roswell, New Mexico crash, and that all the exploration, it'd be going around the U.S., and they'd end up at Area 51. I heard it was going to be about little gray men. That didn't happen. I don't know what happened to that. It ended up being about this crazy whack stuff. I don't know. I just don't like it. Does this have anything to do with religion?
Yes, it does. Because
all right, good.
Apparently, Lucas is not the only person who's been obsessed with these crystal skulls. They first showed up about 50 years ago. Someone discovered one in South America. They called it the Skull of Doom or something like that. I saw this on a National Geographic special. I'll see how much I can recall. But you know, there's a lot of New Age philosophy centers around the power of crystals, and you hold onto the crystal, and you can intersect with energies that way. So the crystal skull is so much more enticing because you have a crystal that's in the shape of a human head, and that's where the knowledge and power comes from. And in the special, they had a guy who's like, I hold the skull, and I can hear it talk to me. And I said before, I don't like to ridicule people for their crazy beliefs, but if you're a singular person and you say something crazy, then yeah, I guess you are crazy. There's these guys who are convinced these crystal skulls are talking to them, when in reality, this National Geographic special showed how there's a place in China. They showed on camera how the guy goes in with machine and cuts this crystal in the shape of a skull, polishes it down, and he made a perfect replica of this Skull of Doom. And also, they took this replica to one of these CSI criminologists who can look at bones and tell you who the person is, where they came from, and said this was patterned after a modern European skull, not an ancient South American one.
Busted.
So, yeah, it's been busted. So, but I was going to say it makes for a good movie, but apparently
it does not.
It does not.
All right. On a completely unrelated note, I read the other day, I haven't watched it myself, apparently Red Letter Media, the people who did the 70-minute takedown of The Phantom Menace, also have one just released of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Check it out if you're interested. I'm not a sponsor, I didn't see it, and I didn't even think The Phantom Menace one was very funny, but there it is.
We'll put the link on if you want to subject yourself to people vomiting hatred for an hour or so.
If you didn't get enough of it here. Well, is it time for TV Corner yet?
It's time for TV Corner. Time for something happy. All right, so today we're talking about the Charlie Brown Christmas special. This has got a special place in a lot of people's hearts, and it's too bad they don't show it as much.
It's on at least once a year.
Yeah, but
maybe twice.
Yeah, but they only show it on, like, I think ABC owns the rights, so they only play.
Yeah, they don't have it on cable like the Grinch.
Yeah, because you see, like, Polar Express
is on a lot.
Yeah,
Elf is on a lot.
Polar Express, I really don't like that movie because it talks about the power of belief.
I don't like the movie because it takes a 6-page children's book and turns it into an hour and 40-minute train ride.
Yeah. Nothing really happens, and it's all about believing, but it doesn't tell you what to believe in other than Santa.
It tells you that there can be miracles if you believe.
If you believe in
Josh,
what?
Josh Groban told me to believe.
Okay.
So I'm gonna.
I'll put a link to something my old theology professor, Dr. Hubby, put up about the power of belief. But anyways, Charlie Brown, you know, he's kind of lost the spirit of Christmas. You know, he's all depressed at the beginning. He's like, I'm supposed to be happy, but I don't feel happy. And I think a lot of us feel that way around Christmas time.
I don't.
You know?
Well, it depends how close it is to Christmas. Usually by the week before I come around.
Yeah. But
like December 2nd, and they've already been playing Christmas music for a week and a half. That's too much. It's like, let me get there on my own. No, I always thought it was convenient just for the plot that, you know, it was like, what, 2 days before Christmas, I guess, in the show, and Charlie Brown's all depressed. That seems artificial that a kid would be.
But he's Charlie Brown. He's always depressed about something.
I guess.
But Lucy tries to cheer him up and says, why don't you direct our play? You know, and so he decides, I'm going to direct this play, but I'm not going to make it be commercial, because I guess the commercialism is getting him down. And I like the line, someone says to Charlie Brown, Christmas is a big commercial racket run by an Eastern syndicate.
That's Lucy.
That's hilarious. You know, he throws a fit because he's trying to direct a play and no one's listening to him. And as a music director myself, I know exactly how he feels. In fact, getting ready for Christmas this year, I threw the same kind of fit. And then I immediately apologized because I actually stomped my feet on the floor like a little 5-year-old.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I should have taped it. It was pretty funny. My team, they were very forgiving, and they actually thought it was kind of funny. Why aren't you listening to me? I threw a little 5-year-old bit. It was, oh well. But anyways, yeah, Charlie Brown does the same thing. So they send him out to get a tree, and then he picks the reject tree, which is sort of a symbol for Charlie Brown.
Yeah. I understand that he was trying to get something that wasn't aluminum and prefab, but really that was the best he could do.
He's Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
What makes Charlie Brown Christmas special so special is that when Charlie Brown brings in the tree, everyone gives him a hard time about it, and he's like, I don't get it. What's all this Christmas all about? And then Linus comes on stage, and he quotes Luke chapter 2, verses 8 through 14. And that makes Charlie Brown feel better. For the first time in the show, we see him smile a bit. And it's the only Christmas special that I know of that actually has something to do with what actually happened on Christmas. You know? Actually quotes scripture. So most of the other Christmas specials are about trains and reindeer and Santa Claus, who is another mythological figure. But this is the only Christmas special that actually talks about the birth of Jesus, which is what we're actually celebrating. And Christmas has gotten so far away from that. And this show came out in the 60s. And I think it's become more commercial. It's more of a secular holiday. And I've seen a lot of blogs and posts online how people are like, you know, this is a secular holiday, and that's fine with me. It's a tradition of going out and buying the tree, putting up the lights.
I'd like to argue in favor of that. Yes, it is still called Christmas to celebrate the birth of Christ. Let's not forget that much like commerce and secularism has kind of horned in on Christmas's action, Christianity itself horned in on early pagan winter rituals of the winter solstice. So there's been a lot of horning in over the years, and I think it's a versatile enough holiday that everyone can celebrate in their own way. Santa Claus can bring you presents. You can hoard all your money and not give your workers the next day off. You can go to church at midnight or at 9 a.m., whichever. In the spirit of Christmas, Christmas can be celebrated any way you want it.
Yeah, because in the future, there's not going to be any Christmas.
It's going to be Xmas.
It's going to be Xmas.
And Santa Claus is gunning you down. I'd like to take this opportunity while Robert was delivering his soliloquy about the crystal skull fabrication just a little while ago. I was looking up this tweet I read a couple days ago from Will Wheaton, from Christmas Day, actually. Aaron Douglas, the man who played Chief Tyrell on Battlestar Galactica, put on Twitter that he was, quote, "watching a Charlie Brown Christmas. Is it just me, or is this far smarter than most shows on TV these days? It's from 1965. And then Will Wheaton, the gentleman who played the classic character of Wesley Crusher on Star Trek The Next Generation, replied, "Research the history of it. The network didn't want to air it because it wasn't commercial enough. Idiots." To which Aaron Douglas replies, "It really is an excellent example of the dumbing down of America. Track the progression from Charlie Brown Christmas to what we have now." I think we can agree that even if, you know, you don't like the secular aspects of it, we can agree that it has at least gotten dumber. They aren't making the same quality of Christmas specials. They're not enduring classics anymore.
Yeah.
You're just going to have knockoffs now.
Yeah.
And I think that's a shame.
Yeah.
I think there is more heartwarming stuff to be said in the same spirit of Charlie Brown and the Grinch.
Yeah, because even if we go back being in an agrarian society rather than a commercial one, if we take back Christmas to what it really was, you know, celebrating the winter solstice at Stonehenge or Woodhenge, wherever you're going to go and celebrate that. In last year's Doctor Who episode, he made a line, "Merry Christmas, we're halfway through the dark." That was it. We're getting back to spring. We know winter's halfway over. There's light at the end of the tunnel. There's hope for next year. The summer, the spring is coming. We should take it back all the way to that instead of pressing forward into spend all your money.
Or we could all get each other fun presents and spend a little money.
Yeah.
In moderation. That's how we had Christmas, and it worked out well.
Yeah. See, Buddha had it right. There's a middle way.
Yes. Moderation in all things is key.
Yeah, there we go.
You know what else sucks?
What?
The Miser Brothers Christmas, which is a spin-off of the characters from Year Without a Santa Claus. They're only in it, like, the last third of the movie. But somehow because they had a catchy song, they weren't their own special. That was atrocious. I saw it last year. It was bad.
I did not see that.
Don't.
Ugh. I'm Mr. Something.
Yes.
That guy?
Yes, those guys.
Ugh. Burger, Meisterburger,
yes,
all that stuff.
Yes, that's the same. I'm pretty sure that's the same one.
I might be getting them mixed up. All those Rankin Bass stop motion things kind of blurred my head.
Burger, Meisterburger might be
that
the
was
story
the Santa
of Santa.
Yeah, that was the Santa Claus
that's,
one.
Yeah, that's not Year Without a Santa Claus.
Ugh.
I don't know. I didn't get to watch any of these this year. I kind of cut back on my Christmas special watching. Kids, all you need is Charlie Brown, Rudolph the Grinch, and I like Garfield. That's a good one. It doesn't get played so much anymore. The George C. Scott version of A Christmas Carol.
That's got everybody in it.
That's an awesome movie.
And Scrooged with Bill Murray.
And I was getting there. And Scrooged with Bill Murray. And Twas the Night Before Christmas, the mouse one with Joel Grey from 1974.
If you're really twisted like me and my wife, we watch The Nightmare Before Christmas.
The less said about that, the better.
That's our special movie. We saw that on our first date.
We saw Lost in Translation and my wife hated it.
My wife hated that too. Bill Murray almost got an Oscar for that one. He should have gotten one for Scrooged as well.
Agreed.
But, you know, while I was watching the Bill Murray Scrooged on TV, I saw a commercial by Rick Perry.
Did you now?
Yeah, he said something.
Was it a car commercial? Is that what he...
No, he was running for office here.
Oh.
And here's what he said.
What office is he running for?
He's running for president.
Oh. What position does he currently hold?
He's governor of Texas.
Wow. A governor of Texas? Let's elect him right now. We saw how well that worked out before.
Wait till you hear what he had to say.
Oh, let's find out.
He said, "I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm a Christian."
I'm happy for him. Good.
I'm not ashamed either.
I'm not ashamed to admit I'm open to other ideas.
Paul said, you know, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel." So, yeah. But he goes on.
Oh,
okay.
Please continue.
He says, "But you don't need to be in the pew every Sunday to know that there's something wrong in this country when gays can serve openly in the military." But
wait, what? That's the same reaction I had during Red State.
"But our kids can't openly celebrate Christmas or pray in school."
Okay, first of all, has he served in the military or been to an elementary school lately? I don't think so.
My kids had Christmas at their school.
I remember having, they may call them holiday parties, because guess what, Rick? Not everybody who goes to school celebrates Christmas.
There's Ramadan. There is Hanukkah. There is Kwanzaa.
I'm sure there's probably others.
Let's light the candles,
There's winter solstice.
Well, hey, a lot of people celebrate the winter solstice. That was very important, especially in an ancient Neolithic agrarian society.
Yes. Again, there's nothing wrong with being gay or serving in the military. one has nothing to do with the other, except for preconceived notions and prejudices about how gay people act.
And I don't understand what being gay and serving in the military has to do with kids being able to pray in school. Is it like someone said, "Well, we got them to stop praying. Now, what's our next step? Gays in the military.
Yeah,
that's what we got to do." It's like someone had an agenda.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Rick Perry goes on to say, because he says, "As president, I'll end Obama's war on religion."
Oh, please. There is no war on religion. The fact that he's saying this proves there is no war on religion.
Did Obama get the Congress together and said, "We need to declare war on any kind of church, any kind of faith. Let's go to war against it.
Absolutely not. This statement is indicative of the belief by fundamentalist Christians that anything that isn't Christian is a war on religion, when it's, in fact, an effort to not be focused on fundamental Christianity. The reason they're called holiday parties in schools is because not everybody celebrates Christmas, not every student is Christian, and since it's being paid for with state money, you are legally, as defined in the Constitution, not allowed to promote one specific religion. It's deliberately neutralized to be all-inclusive.
Right.
You cannot run on a platform saying you're going to end that. That is unconstitutional.
Right. He said, and that's exactly what he says he'll do. It says, "I'll fight against liberal attacks on our religious heritage. Faith made America strong. It could make her strong again."
When did faith make America strong?
Faith made America strong because of the separation of church and state. Here's why. The first time we see the phrase "separation of church and state" is in Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist Association, assuring them that there will not be any one religion put over them where the Baptists would not be able to practice their faith the way they see fit. Because until that time, you had each state, like, you know, Virginia was Anglican, I think. I have to go back and look my history books. But each state, you know, they had Catholic states, they had Anglican states. They kicked all the Anglicans out because they were the Church of England. So the Revolutionary War kind of put an end to them. So we decided, hey, we're going to let everybody practice their religion, because we had Methodists, we had Baptists, we had Catholics who were starting to come. It wasn't more until like the 1800s where you see Catholics and Jewish people come to this country, but there was a lot of very minority Protestant groups who were scared that they wouldn't be able to practice their religion. Now that these small minorities have become the majority, they're still feeling the same thing now.
It's Napoleon syndrome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a modest proposal.
What's that?
If you get the reference. I have a modest proposal for Mr. Perry. Since he's so concerned about America's war on religion, it is a legal precedent in this country that there is a separation of church and state. That comes from. But I suggest we end that and switch to Sharia law. I'm sure Mr. Rick Perry, since he cares so much about religion and keeping America strong with religion, would have no problem instituting Islamic Sharia law
yeah.
in the United States.
Well, Al Franken said he's all for prayer in the schools, but it should be the Shema.
That would work too.
Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. That's the Shema, and that's a Jewish prayer. He said that we should have that in schools.
I can get behind that, too. But my point is, it's ridiculous to just do Christianity because that's what you want.
Right, right. That's what makes America so great, especially for Christians. I've been a member of a Brethren church, which comes from the Anabaptist tradition, where other Protestants and Catholics were both killing Anabaptists for what they believed in. So they come to America and have this freedom where they don't have to, you know, fear that. And no one is threatening to kill anybody. In fact, they made a point on Obama in a recent television show, God in America, where he was making a speech. He said something like this: my religious beliefs might dictate that I think abortion is wrong, but I'm not going to let my belief dictate what is best for the entire country.
Well put, Mr. President.
Yeah, so Obama does not have a war on religion. He is taking a very reasonable stance and actually protecting his religion. Because what if he came out with his religious beliefs and said, I'm going to do everything according to what I believe, even though it's against what, you know, someone like myself might believe.
Yeah, I remember hearing that John Kennedy had to make clear when he took office as president that the Pope wasn't going to be running the United States just because he was Catholic.
Right. And, you know, I don't agree with everything that Obama's done. I thought he would end the war in Iraq, and he did that much later than I hoped he would.
He just stuck to what Bush... Remember when Bush had the shoes thrown at him?
Yeah.
That was the announcement that troops would leave Iraq by December 31st, 2011, which just happened.
Yeah.
So
personally, I don't agree with him giving government funds to abortion clinics because I believe that abortion is wrong. But he's not basing that on his religious belief. He's doing his job as president, which
is to enforce the law of the land.
Right.
Is there any other pertinent quotes we can take apart from this TV ad?
No. The first statement is okay. The last statement is okay. The stuff in the middle is just a mess. It's just a mess.
It's like a crap sandwich.
Yeah. That's how the devil operates, you know. He'll slide in a lie with the truth on the side.
Last but not least, we'd like to briefly discuss, since we're sort of still in TV corner, the funniest SNL sketch they have had in possibly years. Not this past Saturday, but I think the Saturday before.
Yeah.
They had a sketch parodying, for those who aren't in the know, Tim Tebow, quarterback for the Denver Broncos, really loves the Lord. And after every touchdown and, I don't know, maybe every complete pass, I don't watch football. Apparently he praises the Lord right there in the middle of the field.
It's become a meme, an internet meme, Tebowing.
Yes.
You get down on one knee, put your clenched fist against your forehead. I think it's your right arm on your left leg or something like that.
I don't know. On Saturday Night Live, it was the Denver Broncos locker room after a game, and he was telling his teammates how much he thanked Jesus for helping him win, and then Jesus proceeds to come in and tell the Denver Broncos exactly what they're doing wrong.
I have been responsible for your wins. Have you seen how you guys play during the third quarter? Could you do me a favor? Could you, like, stretch beforehand?
They come close to quoting Dr. Zoidberg, and he says something to the, it's not exactly, but he helps those who help themselves.
Yeah. I'll still give you anyone $1 million if you can point that out to me in the Bible. But there is an old Amish quote that says, if you pray for potatoes, grab a hoe. You know, Pat Robertson was very...
A paragon of Christian virtue and knowledge.
Yeah, he was very upset by this. Oh, they're taking apart this young man who's putting his faith out there. And That may be so, but...
I think, having watched it right before we started recording, I think Mr. Robertson is a little off base, because it's not really, it's not blasphemous, it's not heresy, it's making fun of the Broncos.
Yeah.
I think he missed the point. If you really watch it and pay attention to what they're saying, it's mocking their football.
Yeah.
And not the Lord at all.
Yeah. What I thought was funny about it, and it wasn't poking fun at Jesus, it was poking fun at Christians who put faith in Jesus for trivial things. Yeah, we should praise God for everything, but at the same time...
But not after it happens every single time.
Yeah, you know what? Tim Tebow, he threw that football. Jesus didn't throw that football.
Give yourself a little credit, dude. You got a plum gig, and it seems to be working for you.
Yeah.
The Lord may have given you strength to help you achieve it, but all those hours in the gym had something to do with it, too.
Yeah. Also, by making a big show, it's sort of like what Jesus said not to do. You know, don't be like those people who stand on the street corner and pray out loud. Go to your room in secret, and when your Father sees what is done in secret, then you'll be rewarded.
There is a song by my favorite band on their most recent album. It's by Guster. It's called Guster. Stay With Me, Jesus. And it's about exactly this. Robert and I went to see them in concert earlier this year, and the lead singer, Ryan Miller, when he introduced the song, he said, quote, "I love when I see people, like when somebody scores a touchdown, they thank Jesus. This song is about that." And it's, you know, listen to it yourself. Maybe Robert can post a YouTube link.
Yeah.
Listen to it yourself. And with that in mind, see what you think.
It goes right to that. And I think it hurts people who take their faith seriously to see it trivialized when it becomes an internet meme.
Yeah.
You know, when I think it's an affront to people of all faith, you know? So I think Tebow should take Jesus' advice in a sketch, tone it down just a bit.
Yeah.
And then think it's great that, you know, I saw he has a book out where he talks about his faith.
And you know what? Good. That's the place for that.
Right. Maybe once or twice during a game, but going so overboard, it does become trivial, and people don't take you seriously anymore.
I like when I see baseball players thank the Lord after they get a leadoff walk and end up on base. That always amuses me.
I didn't do anything. Thank you, God. I stood there.
Not a strikeout.
I let the ball fly past me. Thank you, Jesus.
Thank you for giving me the strength to lay off that last curveball. Well, I think this episode has... We've been cranky. We've been critical. We've been satirical. And then we have ended with laughter.
It encapsulizes this whole Christmas season.
Exactly. Exactly.
So whether you are Muslim and are enjoying Ramadan, you're Jewish enjoying Hanukkah, whether you're Christian and enjoying Christmas,
African-American and enjoying Kwanzaa,
you're pagan and you're enjoying the solstice,
or whether you're secular and celebrating Festivus, or the Star Wars holiday of Life Day.
I forgot about Life Day.
Have a happy one whenever you listen to this. Break it out every holiday like the Charlie Brown Christmas special. Be sure to join us for our next episode, where we will discuss the recent alien road trip comedy Paul, starring Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, the voice of Seth Rogen, and the full body and potty mouth of Kristen Wiig. And in TV Corner, continuing with the alien theme, we're going to talk about the occasional religious elements of The X-Files, one of my favorite shows of all time.
So until that next episode comes out, the beginning of February, you can visit our website at www.ctgpodcast.com. You can send us an email if you have anything to say about anything we commented on at ctgpodcast@yahoo.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, I've been trying really hard to put something on the Twitter feed at least every day. Links to interesting articles about religion or cool movies that are coming out. You can find that at twitter.com/CTGpodcast. Or you can search for our Facebook feed at Checking the Gate Podcast right there on Facebook. Finally, I thought I'd do something a little different for the holiday episode here. even though this is coming out after all the holidays are over, even Epiphany, I thought I'd play you my rendition of the traditional song Little Drummer Boy. So this is me slapping the bass here. Hope you enjoy. So until next time, this is Robert saying keep the faith.
And this is Mike saying peace out.